Okay, welcome back everyone. Are we recording again, General Manager?
We right.
Thank you. We'll just confirm that the recording is on.
Confirm, yeah.
Thank you. We are now at page 124, a petition headed Recall and Revise the Draft Local Provisions Schedule with a recommendation on page 126. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Councillor Minchley?
Can I ask that we withdraw...
Can you speak up a bit?
Can I ask that we withdraw this... Sorry, remind me of the process, please. Defer. Can I please ask that we defer this item?
So the motion is to defer... And I know that you want to explain why, but until such time as I get a seconder, I can't ask you to explain why. So is there any, which is a very strange process, is it, so Councillor, okay, so we've got a motion from Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley, would you like to speak to that?
Thank you. I'm just trying to find my notes for that, sorry. So we have been written by the person who put the petition forward, asking that we await advice from the Commission in regards to considering the petition. Basically, she sent an email today saying, I've written to the Tasmanian Planning Commission seeking advice as to whether it will require a draft LPS duly endorsed by the planning authority to be submitted. A copy of my email to the TPC is below. It may be prudent to await the Commissioner's advice in this regard prior to before considering the petition, which has the potential to become a moot point. So I'm not sure if staff have any advice to add in regards to that, but I thought in regards to the Ms Oakley's put the petition forward, I thought it'd be worthy of listening to that email.
Thank you. Are you seeking a comment from Ms Tyler-Moore? Ms Tyler-Moore.
Through you, Mayor, we're aware that the question was raised by the resident. We asked the Planning Commission ourselves as well if they had an opinion on it. They've come back to us like moments before 5 o'clock to say that, I should just probably read the email, that they're not making comments, that they're not making a call on whether it is or not, and we could seek legal advice. We have an opinion about whether we think it stands or not, and I'm happy to provide advice on that if the councillors would like to hear it.
Yes, if you could please, Ms Tyler-Moore.
So through you, Mayor, the Act, which obviously we go to, has all the rules about what we can and can't do with respect to doing the draft and also withdrawal, which will need to be noted if the decision is made to withdraw. And I can go into that afterwards. But the LUPA, section 35.7 of LUPA states that a planning authority must not prepare and submit a draft LPS to the Commission under this section unless the planning authority is satisfied that the draft LPS meets the LPS criteria. It does not say it has to be endorsed. It doesn't say that there is a requirement for you to go to the to a council meeting. We did that on top. So the planning authorities of officers who sit as planning authorities, in this instance was Mr Tony Ferrier, who was the main signatory on that report and the letter. He was the planning authority. He did prepare and submit the draft LPS, and he was satisfied that the draft LPS met the LPS criteria, so basically the rules by which we have to do, and it was the LPS was submitted to the Commission under his name, not signed as from the councillors of the council, so the endorsement is not a requirement, and the planning authority was satisfied that it was done in accordance with the rules. So we don't believe there's any issues.
Thank you. Ms Tyler-Moore, is there further discussion? General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. If I may, there can be no further discussion. There can be questions, but we have a procedural motion before us to defer. And unless there are questions, the Mayor will have to put it to the vote.
Thank you. Questions?
Question.
Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is, what are the perceived benefits and what are the perceived problems with deferring this matter?
Ms Tyler-Moore.
Through you, Mayor, from my position... doing the work on the LPS there is, and where we are and the requirements, and we haven't got direction to do the public exhibition yet. I see no issue about whether it's deferred or decided tonight. I understand that Councillor Midgley was asking about whether there's any obligations about resolution of petition. I don't know the answer to that. The General Manager won't know the answer to that, and I'm sure would have spoken if that was an issue. So I don't see any... It makes no difference, really, at this point in time.
Thank you, Ms Tyler-Moore. Councillor Dean, did you have a question? Okay, so if there are no further questions, then I'm going to put the motion for deferral, which is moved by Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Yes.
Okay, show of hands is required. All those in favour of deferral is Councillors Cordova, Bain, Midgley and Reet. Those against? Councillors Antoli, Fox, Dean, Richardson, Street and Gladewright. The motion is lost. So we're back on the substantive motion, which was moved by Count... No, it was not. Okay, so we need a mover and a seconder for the substantive motion. Thank you. Councillor Gladewright has moved nearly every motion this evening, so... thank you, and seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Gladewright.
Okay, thank you. The purpose of this report is to consider a petition asking that Council request of the Minister and the Tasmanian Planning Commission to recall the draft local provision schedule. This is a subject which I've spent a lot of time trying to get my head around. The topic was first brought to light, I guess, in the campaign period when there was a lot of community angst over the draft provision schedule. I've spent a lot of time reading emails, a lot of conversations with planners, trying to understand. And where I am sitting currently is still a bit of an impasse, because on the one hand we've got some community members who are claiming one thing about the proposed zoning, and on the other hand we have our staff members who are telling us a very different story. So it is quite difficult to balance those two things. My understanding in doing a lot of research is that the experiences of the Huon Valley were quite different to what is happening here in Kingborough. The Huon Valley went down this process a lot earlier than we did. At that time, they didn't even have any expert planners working for them, and so somebody was asked to apply some zoning. And in the Huon Valley, a lot of the pre-existing zoning was rural living. So when you apply landscape conservation zoning over a rural living zone, I can fully understand how that could be considered a downzoning. And as such, there has been quite a lot of, you know, community angst and different things that are happening in the Huon Valley. Here, though, in Kingborough, it is my understanding that a lot of the properties that are proposed for landscape conservation zone were already in an environmental living zone. And when you compare the two, while I completely accept that they're not exactly like for like, that there isn't... It's not actually going to be as bad as is sort of being made out in the community. You can still build a single dwelling, an ancillary dwelling, extend your deck, build your pool, put in your shed, put on an extension, do your big driveway. It's not as sort of punitive as has been described in the past. Having said that, I very much appreciate the advocacy that the community are doing around the landscape conservation zoning, because what they've been able to do is highlight some instances where the landscape conservation zoning may have been applied in Kingborough that was indeed an overreach. And I think that we've had a commitment from our expert planners that they're going to relook at the mapping and iron out some of those areas where overreach may have been applied. We have also discovered that we needed to allocate some extra resourcing to communicate effectively with our community, so we decided that we were going to send out some letters explaining to people about the proposed zoning. We've also committed to providing some additional information sessions. They're now currently up on the Kingbury Council website on the front page, and there's, we were discussing earlier, you can book in. I find it comforting to hear that when people are ringing our expert planners with concerns about the landscape conservation zoning in regards to their own individual properties, that our expert planners are able to go through those individual properties, and that most people are actually comforted by the information that they are getting. So I feel that we shouldn't be withdrawing the draft local provision schedule. I think we've got many places where we can capture the concerns of the community, starting with those information sessions or indeed a phone call. If they still have concerns, then there are still going to be three more processes, the public exhibition period, then there's the ability for us as the planning authority to express our opinion on representations that we receive, and then thirdly there'll be the public hearing process. So if we haven't captured concerns somewhere along in that whole series of different places where we can capture them, then I don't believe that's going to happen. I think that we're going to end up with mapping of zoning where everyone is going to feel comfortable with the changes. So I support the recommendation that we note the petition. I thank the petitioners for alerting us to this topic early on. It's been a very informative time for us, learning about some very complex changes. I can encourage the community to continue to engage with our staff, and I support the recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cladright. I've got Councillor Bain next and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions. Under recommendation B, where it talks about the TPC is undertaking a review of the proposed application of landscape conservation zone in Kingborough, with revisions to be provided for council endorsement prior to public exhibition. Interested to know what would happen if those revisions came to council and we weren't happy with them. What would be the next step?
Ms. Tallamore.
Through you, Mayor, we have had these discussions about what process we will have about the revisions coming back to council and the endorsement. As I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about whether it was endorsed to start with or not, it's not strictly an endorsement that's required under LUPA. We would need to consider what the approach is, whether it's accepted or whether there's another decision made by council. If it wasn't supported and if it was in its entirety or in part, sorry, that sounds like a bit of a vague answer, but we have been working together in sort of with a governance type hat on as well about what would occur in that instance.
Okay. And just under 4.4, where it says the council met with the Tasmanian Planning Commission in December to request a review, and the Commission's advised that it's undertaking this review. Is council still able to have input with the TPC about changes, or are they doing them solely by themselves?
Ms. Tallamore.
Through you, Mayor. The review... Sorry, I should probably go to 4.4 just to double-check. So we had a meeting with the Tasmanian Planning Commission. We went in and we certainly raised the issues. The residents have raised... Some residents have raised with the Landscape Conservation Zone. Obviously, they read paper and they know of Huon Valley as well, so they've taken into consideration some of that. And we've advised them that we would be looking at some of the mapping and possibly going to change some of that mapping, which may result in some changing away from landscape conservation. Others may go to landscape conservation because it'll just be on the merits of the actual properties. So they're not doing it on their own. It'll certainly come from us. But when we have the post-lodgement meetings, they come up with a whole series of questions and maps, and they might ask specific questions about that. So they might pick out particular properties and say, we question why you were doing that. Was it an error? Should you consider using this other zone? So they have raised some of those with us, but to do with all sorts of things. Not landscape conservation is only one small part of the whole planning scheme. So, yes, they do look at it, but we're also doing a lot of work on it, and they're expecting we will come back with changes.
Okay, and just through you, Mayor. So some of the community feedback that you're receiving is still able to be communicated to the TPC through those meetings?
Through you, Mayor. Yes, we keep in contact with them regularly. We're probably in contact with them every week about some of those adjustments, but certainly we need to go back with a full report to them responding to their queries, and we'll also include other work that we've done. And to date, they've been quite favourable about the work that we've done in many parts of the planning scheme, which has been good.
And just one last question.
That's right. Councillor
Bain. So one of the things the petition was asking for is to commit to directly notify all owners of property that have changed of zone proposed in the LPS. I thought, did we commit to doing that through the rates notices coming up or not?
Ms Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, my understanding is that the resolution was that we would hold the LCZ information sessions, which is what we're doing in February, those two, and that we wouldn't have a notice only to LCZ because that's too narrow, really. If the rights notices, depending on the time of when we go to exhibition and the rights notices, you could have a piggyback letter in there about the planning scheme more generally. If the timing is right, but noting not everybody gets the quarterly rates notice because some people pay the whole year. But certainly there's going to be a big communications plan to reach people about the changes to the scheme.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Next I had Councillor Dean.
Just one quick question before I make a few comments. By supporting this recommendation, I just want to clarify this doesn't prevent us from withdrawing at a later date if we seeking to withdraw at a later date if we see so fit.
Through you, Mayor, that's correct. You could make an application to withdraw at a later date. There are some parameters about when you can do that, and it's and I'm happy to double check it, but it's up until the Section 35F report, which is the one where we come back with the representations to withdraw.
Given that, I think, I'm of the view to support the recommendation because we're not ruling it out forever. As Councillor Bain has alluded to, there's going to be some back and forth anyway, and there already has been a lot of back and forth. And I think the main point for me to support this recommendation, although it's obviously not going to be what the petitioner wants to hear, but hopefully it is, in fact, is that I've seen since that campaign a clear willingness from Council, from whenever we've talked about this, it's come up for discussion with us in workshops, to take another look at this. And that's, as the officer's already mentioned, is already happening. Whether that's through the workshops that we're about to hold, whether it's from the commitment we had previously when we discussed this on the 5th of December, that, yes, as Councillor Gladewright pointed out, there potentially was some overzealous use of LCZ and we're going back now and looking at it. So given that we're not ruling this out in perpetuity, and the fact that Council staff and I know the Planning Commission are clearly listening to us and the Huon Valley they obviously read the paper, they know what's going on and they are making already some concessions. So as it stands right at this point, I'm happy to support the officer's recommendation.
Thank you. Next I have Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Mine are questions. I don't have comments at this stage because I'd like some questions answered first. The officer's report that says it is unlikely that the Tasmanian Planning Commission will accept a request for withdrawal based on what happened in Huon Valley, how does that apply given they went through the exhibition process and the TPC's response basically points to that and almost says, look, you're going to create community confusion. We haven't gone through that. How is that a like-for-like comparison?
Ms. Tyler-Moore. Sorry, Dr. Fox. Beg your pardon.
Through you, Mayor. I would point out that the council report does say that the Huon Valley went through their public exhibition process and then sought to have it withdrawn. We're at a different stage, as has been mentioned. We haven't yet gone to public consultation. The conversations that we've had with the Commission and our understanding of what the Commission has said to Huon Valley is that they have faith in the public exhibition process and the ability of the Planning Authority to provide advice following that public exhibition process. So as a Planning Authority, you will view all of the representations that come in through that public exhibition process, provide advice then to the Commission, then it goes to public hearings, and all of those issues that are raised will be considered by the Commission. So our understanding is that the Commission would like to see that process roll out for all of the LPSs in Tasmania that are yet to be finalised, and that the TPC and the Minister are reluctant to delay those processes from going forward. There's great motivation in the state government, as you would be aware, to have all of the LPSs in place across Tasmania and to have the Tasmania Planning Scheme in place. So we believe that the Commission would be unlikely to recommend to the Minister that it would be withdrawn, that it could be withdrawn.
So to clarify, it's your opinion that probably the weight of evidence is more around a need to hurry up and move on, given that this was 3 years ago when we lodged ours, rather than necessarily comparing the like-for-like process that they went through and we're going through.
Dr. Fox. Through you, Mayor. Correct, but what I would say is that I think the Commission and we would like to see this go through to full public consultation so everybody has a chance to have their say. At the moment, we've got some members of the community who have made comment based on what they think is in there, and everybody, we haven't had a full consultation, we haven't had drop-in sessions, we haven't had public forums, people haven't been given the opportunity to understand what the changes are and haven't been given the opportunity to have their say and for that to be considered by all of you and to be considered by the Commission. So it's our opinion that the Commission would want to see that process undertaken before making a determination on whether this LPS is requires further amendment or is appropriate. Makes sense?
Councillor Antoli.
My comment is that when you say that we want it to continue, who's the we, the staff or the Planning Authority?
My understanding, and coming into this fairly late, but my understanding is that the Tasmanian Planning Commission, the state government, want to see the Tasmanian Planning Scheme implemented as soon as possible.
Yes.
As council staff, we would like to move to public consultation, but we do need to have the TPC approve that happening.
I think it's fair to say we need to be moving at a pace that is within the law but is right for our community, not for what the Planning Commission wants. My next question is regarding the actual minutes to the meeting of December 9, 2019, when the Council voted to draft and submit the LPS. In the minutes at the back, there's some information about from the Planning Commission that was submitted about what the approval process is. It's dated April 2017, and I've got a copy of it in my hands and I'm more than happy to submit it. It says that the first step before the draft is lodged is that the PA, the Planning Authority, I'm quoting, the PA prepares the draft LPS and submits to the Commission. The Planning Authority didn't actually meet on that day under the Planning Authority guidelines before it submitted the permission, the draft LPS. So I struggle to understand the legal advice that Ms. Tyler-Moore received from the lawyers to say that someone like Mr. Ferrier and company can actually lodge when the actual Planning Authority didn't meet to agree. They met as a council in open session, yes, but they didn't meet under the provisions of the plan, under the status of we are now entering into a planning authority. And so I'm wondering whether or not the actual lodgement that we made back then is, I won't use the word illegal, but breach of process. If that's the case, that's in contradiction to the legal advice we've received and has been a cause of concern from the community that we actually breached process. Is any comment on that, or am I wrong? Or
Ms. Tullamore has her light on.
Through you, Mayor, I did make comment on this earlier. Firstly, I just want to clarify we didn't get legal advice, that the interpretations of the Act. So, as I read out earlier, a planning authority must not prepare and submit the draft LPS to the Commission under the section unless the planning authority is satisfied that the draft LPS meets the LPS criteria. So certainly the councillors didn't prepare the draft. It came to the council meeting. The planning authority is those who have delegation under the general manager as the planning authority. So day to day I am the planning authority, or the coordinator as the planning authority, or the general manager as the planning authority. The council can sit as a planning authority on occasion, and which we do, and we have certain parameters that we've set ourselves when matters come to the chamber, and it's correct. So for example, tonight we had two matters. We stopped as council and we sat as you sat as the planning authority. So the planning authority preparing it was the council officers and Tony Ferrier, and it went through, so we believe that there's not an issue about what happened on that evening. And as I said earlier in the meeting, there's nothing in the Act about requirement of endorsement.
Yes, I'm no lawyer. My understanding is there are only 10 people that can act as the planning authority or delegate their authority to someone to do so. So was a vote taken where the planning authority of the 10 councillors at the time delegated their responsibility to yourself or the general manager to lodge the LPS?
General manager.
Through you, Mayor. Not as you phrased that question, Councillor Antoli, but the delegation in place at the time for Tony Ferrier and indeed myself. Tony Ferrier was the Deputy General Manager of Council at the time, and the delegation that was provided to him and to me by the Council and in turn to him allowed us, acting as the Planning Authority, to actually forward the draft planning scheme to the Commission. So, as Ms. Tyler Moore has previously indicated on a couple of occasions now, we are quite comfortable as council officers that the planning authority has acted in accordance with the legislation.
Councillor Antoli.
Okay, thank you for answering that question. I had another question for you. So that part of the reason, my understanding, having talked to the people behind the petition, and I do believe it's the tip of the iceberg, is that there is no like for like. We know this movement from ELZ to the new schedule, whatever is the correct word, the new codes under the new the new setup, but the most appropriate movement from environmental living is probably more towards rural living rather than LCZ. So it's of the 1,900 or so properties that are currently overlaid for LCZ, some 80 to 90% would naturally fit rural living. So the question is, since so many didn't go to rural living and such a huge majority went to LCZ rather than being in the minority, there's concern that people, that it wasn't probably considered well. So there's a real concern that when we go through the consultation process, that the residents will not be listened to, the consultation process will stand, the reduction in numbers from 1,940 properties down will be minimal, and people will be captured and steamrolled by the process, by the bureaucratic process. And so the desire is for those 1,940 properties to be re-looked at and for a discussion to be had internally, and we do have planning officers that have agreed that it was handled rather over enthusiastically some years ago, the way the overlays were done, to reduce that number dramatically from the 1,940 down before even going to consultation. And the only way to do that is to withdraw the draft LPS. Is that not correct?
Ms. Tullamore?
Through you, Mayor, just I disagree about the assessment that was suggested that it was wrong and was used incorrectly, and I don't think that that necessarily is the question before us. It's about the petition generally, not about, I'm not going into a discussion about the merits of rural living or otherwise, and we have applied them, and I strongly disagree that officers have said that they were applied over enthusiastically. They were used a methodology. We acknowledge that we can't look at every property with 33,000 properties, and we've taken that on board and reviewing that, so it is in hand. The withdrawing the LPS isn't going to mean that everything gets converted to the opinion of some people who think that one zone is better than the other zone, and I think that's where the drop-in sessions are going to be important for them to understand what it would mean. As an example that was suggested was the rural living, what that actually means for them. Are they happy that their neighbours can build certain industrial uses, verging on industrial uses so close to their property boundaries, and that their road may see a sharp increase in the number of residents in that area because the subdivision potential is quite different. So there's lots of elements to consider rather than just picking one particular zone out of there. But without going into the merits, because it's not really about the merits, it's about withdrawing the LPS, it's important that people actually understand the meaning of these things rather than some of the comments that are made on certain channels about what you can or can't do, and we really want people to understand that rather than being scared. And they may very well resolve, know that they absolutely think landscape conservation is the wrong one for their area once they've had the opportunity to get the detail about what that actually means for them or their neighbouring properties, because it's not just about them, it's about what their neighbours are going to be capable of doing. So we think that that's an important process to go through.
I have sat with Adrian Stander. We've all been here with him, and he made it very clear to us that the way it was, the overlays were done back then, he would not have done them. He believes that there were problems in the way it was handled. He believes, and definitely I got the impression, that more properties were captured under LCZ than probably should have been. Yes. So you said to me a moment ago that I misrepresented it as being overly enthusiastic, but he made it very clear to us that it probably wasn't handled well. Is that not correct? Have you not been at those meetings?
Ms. Tarnall.
Through you, Mayor, I have been at the meetings, and over-enthusiastic is different to the methodology may not have been right or may not have been accurate for every property, and we've acknowledged that, and that's why we're doing the extra work. And we always said, and if you read the report in December 2019, it also acknowledges in that report that there may be properties that haven't fallen quite into the right zone or other codes because of the scale of the work that's involved. So we're happy to review it. That's what we're reviewing. But it's on balance of what the criteria of those zones are. It's not just an opinion or a feeling, and we're working through those.
And my final question, thank you, Ms. Tyler Moore. My final question, Mary, is what are any negative repercussions to us as council in our relationship with the Planning Commission or in our own process, is there in adopting the petition's proposal to withdraw the LPS?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor. I wouldn't want to make assumptions about relationships between the TPC or the state government and ourselves about what would happen, but as we've made clear before, one option that they could come up with is that they choose to take on the power of dealing with the planning scheme. So it's taken away from council, and they will make the decisions about that, which may have ramifications about resolutions that are made by the council, by staff, or from talking to the community. They would still need to go through the public exhibition process and the hearings, but they take on that power in lieu of it. They could do that regardless, even if we didn't ask for the withdrawal, but I can't predict what their response would be. We do have the response, we're aware of the response to Huon Valley and how they've responded, that they feel that there's not really a net benefit of doing the withdrawal and resubmitting, but that's up to the councillors to decide whether they want to pursue that.
So you're saying if we just simply ask to withdraw the LPS and vote to do so tonight, that they will punitively take over as the planning authority here?
Ms. Tolemore.
Through you, Mayor, that is not what I said.
I'm asking, is that what you said?
That is not what I said.
It sounded like something like that. What did I miss here? You're saying that that could be one of their responses rather than coming back with a letter saying, no, you can't withdraw, that they will take over as the planning authority?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, what I said, that they have the power to do it, to make it aware, because we have raised it before, and I think it's only fair that the councillors are aware that there is an option for the minister to call it in if it's not resolved or not moving forward. Whether the minister would or wouldn't do that, I'm not involved in that area. They haven't done it to date. Doesn't mean that they wouldn't do it, but the councillors should be aware that it's a possibility. And no, I'm not suggesting that that is what they're going to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Dean.
Happy to call someone to call point of order on this one, but just to maybe help clarify Councillor Antolli's line of questioning, is there any potential, given that in the discussion previously we've had staff have had weekly meetings with TPC and we've had the post-lodgement conferences and one was in December, is there able to give some kind of confirmation as to the 1952 properties where we are currently now sitting, just to provide those listening and potentially Councillor Antolli a little bit of reassurance, given that on December 5th, the General Manager did allude to a significant downwards pressure on that number, but could you potentially update us on where we're at with those number of properties?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I just want to clarify that there haven't been necessarily weekly meetings with the TPC, just in case they get thrown out. We did have the formal post-lodgement meeting with them, and we probably speak to them about weekly, roughly, because we're asking different inquiries or checks, because we don't want to go too far down the road for them to say otherwise. So it's a good working relationship with that respect. The work that we've been doing on reviewing the LCZ at this stage looks like, and it's not completed yet, because if you can appreciate, it does take a lot of work to go through them all, that it could be somewhere around 300 properties difference. Might be more because we haven't finished the work, but that's where we are at to date. That's our assessment so far. That doesn't mean that the TPC will necessarily agree with that. They may look at properties and say, well, that should be LCZ. But using what we can, that would be what our recommendation is. And even if we did change one way or the other, it's still important that residents are involved in the whole process, and we encourage their involvement and their questions and queries in that, so they have an understanding of that. It's a really important part of the process, and we're happy to obviously provide that advice all the time to people.
Just want to say thank you for the transparency and openness to, I guess, a 20% reduction already at this stage sounds like a significant number. And it shows for me that, as a staff, that we are working with the Commission and we are listening. And so a 20% figure already at this stage sounds potentially promising for, hopefully, for the community to hear. So thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Is there any further discussion? No? Okay. If not, Councillor Gladwright, did you want to sum up?
Just to say thank you to the petitioner, who played a really big role in advocating for this topic during that campaign period. It is appreciated that these types of issues are brought to council, and I'm really encouraged by the response that the staff have taken to those concerns, the fact that we're looking at the zoning and that there'll be plenty of opportunity for people to make a representation, and that those concerns are still able to be captured as we go down the process.
Thank you, Councillor Gladwright. I'm going to put the motion as printed on page 126 of the agenda. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Against.
Show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Fox, Cordova, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson, Street, Gladwright and Reet. Those against? Councillor Antolli. The motion is carried. We now move to page 127, Land Donation, Hobart Women's Shelter, with a recommendation on page 130. I've got a mover in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Tonight we are looking at a report because Council has received a formal proposal from the Hobart Women's Shelter for a partnership in which land in Gormley Drive would be donated for the development of long-term housing for women and children. I'd like to acknowledge the Mayor on her advocacy in this after attending Greater Hobart Mayor's Forum, and the General Manager and Mr Smee for the hard work in putting this report together. I understand it is a big one, and a one that has not come before Council. I don't know if it's been ever or for a very long time that we're actually considering a donation of land. We can see from the many statistics in the report that sadly more than ever women and their children are sleeping rough and in unstable accommodation, and this is just not okay. Sadly, in my other role that I do from Council, I see the effects on children who are living in unstable accommodation and the impact this has on their wellbeing and education and attending school, and that just should not happen in Australia. And we're not alone in local government looking for solutions to solve the housing crisis. You can see examples in this report in Tasmania, Dorset, Brighton and Devonport who have provided land donations. And at this point in time, like never before, should state, local and federal governments work together to provide a solution. So gifting of land is one of the main mechanisms identified for councils in the Municipal Victoria report that's attached to this document, that they do some really great work in Victoria, the MAV. Just gifting of land is one of the main mechanisms identified for councils to support the development of social housing, and the guide states that this option is most appropriate in circumstances where council's primary objective is to maximise the delivery on a small number of sites. There is an opportunity whereby the Hobart Women's Shelter is available and seeking land to build transitional land for women and their children. So we had a workshop on this as councillors. We know that the Hobart Women's Shelter are looking to apply for a grant, and there are a number of grants available via state and federal government to support this. So as stated in the report, the land is part of the Kingborough Sports precinct title and will need to be subdivided before it can be transferred as a discrete title. It is zoned community purposes, in which residential use is discretionary for multiple dwellings or community housing. In accordance with the above, both subdivision and development applications will need to be submitted to Council for statutory assessment. So we're not making a decision on the fly tonight. There's a bit of a process forward going forward. The land in Gormley Drive is unsuitable for development as a recreational space, and its community purpose zoning land lends itself well to the proposed use for long-term housing for women and children. And the Kingborough Sports Precinct Future Directions Plan does not identify a use for the land other than that for a potential for a pathway on the southern end to provide a pedestrian connection to the Kingston High School. So it seems like a good identified land that the Mayor and staff have come up with. So we know that the Hobart Women's Shelter will have to go under an approvals process, and the alternative to gifting the land is a long-term lease. And as noted in the MAV guidelines, this option is appropriate in circumstances where Council's key objective is to retain the asset, where transfer of the title would be complex, and where there is a reasonable expectation that the land will be required for another purpose in the future. I don't think homelessness is going to go away, unfortunately. It's only going to get dire before it gets better. Look what's happened in Huntingfield, the fast-track land supply order. I reckon we're going to get our, if this goes ahead, we're probably going to get the housing here before Huntingfield happens, Council leading the way again. Given that Council has no imperative to retain the asset, transfer of the title can be achieved through a subdivision process and no alternative future use of the land has been identified, and gifting of the land is a valid consideration as stated in the report. The Hobart Women's Shelter has indicated they would pay full rates in the homes once developed that over time would offset the value of the land donation. And there's a point about that Council would need to write off the land in the year that the donation takes place, and advice from the Tasmanian Audit Office would be required. And so gifting of the land is considered appropriate given the urgent community need of this nature. And I hope that councillors support the recommendation that we give it its in-principle support of the proposal, with a next step for council required to undertake a public notification process, consider any objections received and obtain a valuation of the land before making a final decision. I've just got a couple of questions. So what if the Hobart Women's Shelter does not get the funding or enough funding from the grants that they're applying for? What will happen then?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, I would envisage that Council would make any final approval for for the transfer of land conditional upon the Hobart Women's Shelter being able to demonstrate that they have the funding to proceed.
Thank you. And what if we have a situation where they need to sell, say, if it all does then go ahead, if they need to sell the land due to a debt or an organisational crisis, what would we need to do there?
Mr Smee.
Through you, Mayor. Again, Council may wish to place a condition on the sale of the land that a covenant be placed in relation to a reversionary covenant that in the event that the land can no longer be used for the intended purpose for accommodation, it reverts back to council ownership.
Great, thank you. So just to be clear on what step and stage would that come to, noting tonight, or I guess as well, Mr Smee, if you'd like to add anything more that what I might have missed in regards to giving some more understanding and insight into that in-principle support decision that we're making tonight as well.
Mr Snape.
Through you, Mayor, I think the key thing to remember tonight is that we need to go through a process as prescribed by the regulations. Council will then need to consider a further report, and that's the crunch time, and that's the time in which Council will need to determine, will need to consider any objections received, and then provide the detail in relation to the conditions of transfer of the land. So I think the fine detail in relation to a decision to donate the land will come in the next report to council and in the next decision of council. At this stage, it's purely an in-principle agreement to go through the prescribed process.
Thank you. And so that in-principle agreement will therefore then mean that the Hobart Women's Shelter can apply for these grants now, if this is decided tonight?
Mr Smee.
Through you, Mayor, it would certainly provide the Hobart Women's Shelter with, I guess, a degree of support. Whether it would be enough to satisfy a funding provider, I couldn't comment on. I would suspect a funding provider is going to want a firm decision. However, it's certainly a very positive indication of support in which they can go forward with.
Thank you. And for open and being open and transparent, why I guess the Hobart Women's Shelter have come to us with this proposal. So why are we, I guess, progressing with the Hobart Women's Shelter and not, I guess, looking at any other community services? And I'm very happy to support it, but I guess for open and transparency, it would be good to hear about that as well, please.
Mr Smee.
Through you, Mayor, I think the key consideration here is that we have an urgent social need. We have a provider that has come to us with a proposal to meet that social need. We need to go through a process that is open and transparent, that will, you know, potentially flush out whether there's any other providers out there that may have a better model to offer us that will come out through this next process. But at this point in time, you know, this is the best offer that we have to meet this urgent social need.
Thank you. And I'd just like to echo the sentiments that the Hobart Women's Shelter has been providing accommodation for women and children for over 30 years. And I thank them for all the work they do. So I hope we get support, and no doubt there will be a lot of questions because it is important that we discuss this matter tonight.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. I'll certainly be supporting the recommendation for all the reasons Councillor Midgley's mentioned. So much good could come from this. And look forward to seeing the report that comes to Council. One of the things in the recommendation is that it'll be going to out for public comment, and I think given that it says that it's zoned in the Kingborough Sports Precinct, some people might look at that and think, why aren't we using that for the Kingborough Sports Precinct? So is it possible to get some more information on why it's not suitable to be used for that purpose?
Mr Smee.
Through you, Mayor. Principally, the answer to that is zoning. The rest of the precinct is zoned recreation. this has a specific zoning of community purposes. So quite clearly the intent in years gone by has been to identify this parcel of land as being suitable for community housing, for grouped housing, and we now have a proposal that aligns perfectly with the zoning. The site cannot be used for recreation because it's not zoned that way. And there is a very limited section of the precinct. It includes the community gardens and Kingston Men's Shed that's zoned community purposes. And you know, clearly, in years gone by, there was an intent that this land be used for community purpose, such as what we are now considering.
Thank you. Councillor Antoli. And
thank
then
you,
Councillor Cordova.
I fully support this. I know Janet Saunders, the CEO, professionally quite well. Her office is 300 metres from my office and we work in the same sector. They are a quality organisation. Women and children are way far impacted on the subject of domestic violence than men, not to take anything away from men that do suffer domestic violence, but there are solutions for them, but the numbers are massive against women and children. So to provide something like this close to schools, which it will be, close to a place for the kids to run around and do recreation. So in such a great use of space is a fantastic idea, and I fully support it, and I hope it. I hope that they get their funding, and I really look forward to some great things happening there, and I really doubt that there could be anything much said against the proposal, to be honest, from a community point of view.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor, and I'd like to echo my colleague's statements. Absolutely, what Councillor Antoli just said, this is an urgent social need, and I'm pleased that we're embarking upon a fair process, transparent process, and there'll be due diligence done, but hopefully a positive outcome. I would like to also reflect what Councillor Midgley spoke about, that, for example, in years gone by, there may have been either religious or sporting organisations that were gifted land for a certain purpose, and then 50 years later, because of legal issues, they then liquidated their assets in order to pay compensation to various people. And that's why I think it's so important that we take note of 8.1, that there's a risk that having transferred ownership of land, it will be sold or not developed for that intended purpose, and this can be mitigated through the inclusion of appropriate clauses in the condition of sale, which we've heard about. I'll be very interested to see what exactly those restrictive covenants look like, or some covenant on title specifying those conditions on which the land can be used. As for 8.2, where it says council can also exercise a degree of ongoing control over the use of the land through planning provisions, my understanding was that would be a fairly involved process, and so initially I was a bit sceptical about what's the likelihood that we would undertake some kind of planning amendment. To my mind, it's quite rare and difficult, so I'm not sure that provides specific protection, but maybe if I've misinterpreted that, maybe I'll ask that as a question. How easy would it be for council to undertake, as it says in 8.2, a degree of control via planning provisions? How easy is that process?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, the point I was making is that it's zoned community purposes. So it's not like it can be sold to a developer who is going to do a residential development. So to change that zoning from community to residential is a difficult process that council controls. So I guess the risk that this land will be sold in the future to a private commercial developer is really low because of its zoning, and that's the point I'm trying to make in terms of that particular control.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. And through you, Mayor, I was thinking about the alternative would be in order to exercise maximum control. Bear in mind that I totally take on board what's just been said, and I agree with it. I think that's really provides a great deal of comfort, not just to me, but I'm sure to the community who wants the best outcome for this land. If we wanted to exercise full control, an alternative model, of course, would be a long-term lease, and I realise that there might be implications for the women's shelter in terms of securing, you know, grant funding. But I would have thought that surely like a 50-year lease at peppercorn rent would have the same weight to it to somebody who's assessing a grant eligibility criteria, but I don't know.
But having said that, if we were to go down that alternative route of a long-term lease at peppercorn rent, similar to, you know, many organisations that are in the municipality already, that would come with its own set of challenges. For example, every time they want to renovate or move something around, there would be all this unnecessary rigmarole and bureaucracy that actually will get in the way of the positive outcomes that they're trying to achieve. So having said all of that, I think fundamentally this could be a very good news story in amongst what is an absolute urgent social need. There's no doubt that there is probably no better thing that we could do in terms of trying to address the scourge of family violence than to actually provide tangible, real-time support, and I think it just shows the power that local councils do indeed have to provide positive social benefit and to actually be there for their community when they need it most. So I wholeheartedly support this proposal.
Thank you. Councillor Fox?
Well, it's very difficult to speak against the motion when I've heard so many really positive comments and answers to all the questions. I think what's burning me up is a lot of people in the community have spoken to me about the concept that local government's getting involved in social housing and that we haven't done so in the past, and that the state and federal government are letting us down to this extent that we are prepared to go down this road. The other time we went down a similar path was with Manor Gardens, and I agree that maybe the conditions of sale on that weren't well and truly tightened up at the time, but it is an example of what can go wrong, where we put a lot of effort and energy and resources into a community asset which is then vaporised under our very noses. And that is my major concern, the one that Councillor Midgley raised. If they are sued and they need to sell this property or hand it over to someone who is suing them, we've got to make it really absolutely watertight. But I also don't know the value of the land. I mean, we're getting a valuation, but I'd like to know roughly what are we actually giving away in terms of value, but also in terms of future value of the use of that land for other purposes like community gardens or men's sheds, which are not being provided by state or federal government. They're not giving us land for those things. It's our land that's being used. And why aren't the state and government, state and federal governments, fronting up with that cash to buy the land off us if that's something that they see as a priority? I feel we're reacting quite emotionally to the dire need and the urgent social need in this situation rather than protecting council's resources for what they're intended to and intended for and not picking up the tag for state and federal government. So I have concerns. I don't know if council staff would like to comment. I raised those concerns at the workshop as well. And in principle, I can't, and everybody's emotionally in favour of this, I can't afford politically to go against it. But I'm not very happy about it. Anybody like to comment?
Do you mean from the staff? Well, I didn't hear a question in that. I heard an opinion, but I wasn't aware that there was a question. I'm sorry if I've missed it.
Yes, my question is, why is it that we in local government are now in this position, and why is it that the state and federal government aren't putting their hands up to help us out? Would anybody on staff get a feeling about that? I know it's a political
Mr.
question.
Me.
Through you, Mayor, I guess the answer from state or federal government would be that we view this as a partnership in which council would provide the land, an organisation would facilitate the development, and the federal or state government would provide the funding for the capital. And that's certainly been the case in the other examples that have been provided in this report, where it's viewed very much by state and federal government as being a partnership approach in which council brings to the table a parcel of land that has been identified as being appropriate for the use, and otherwise surplus to requirements. And certainly in this situation, I can only reiterate the point that this land is zoned community purposes. We've had a strategic assessment of the precinct done. It did not identify a future use for this land other than a pedestrian linkage, which can be facilitated through this process. And we have identified no other future use for the land, and this appears to be a very good opportunity to meet what is an urgent need.
Thank you, Mr. Smee. Councillor Dean and then Councillor Richardson.
I was going to say a few things along Mr. Smee's line there about this isn't necessarily just council doing the heavy lifting, this is actually us facilitating through federal and state grants. And that is what needs to happen when it comes to affordable housing. It cannot just be one level of department or one state level or federal or council in itself. There just aren't the resources. We've got the land, they've got the funding. So on that, I think this is a really great example of actually multi-governance coming together to get a really good outcome. But in terms of what Mr. Smee talked about in terms of finances, I understand that in essence we're gifting, but given that the zoning implication of this land, in actual fact, it seems to be we're going to be quite far ahead, given in the report it acknowledges that we're going to be getting full rates. So I guess my question is I'm going to sleep easy at night supporting this, but in terms of a financial perspective, what are we better off now that we're potentially going through with this versus having a piece of land that is otherwise being underutilised? Have we got any numbers on that yet?
I think the answer is no, but Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, the independent valuation will assess the potential value of the land based on its zoning. So, I mean, if this land was residentially zoned and could be sold for commercial development, it'd be worth $2-3 million. But given its zoned community purposes, it has a really limited range of uses. If it became a community garden, council's income would be a peppercorn. So in that regard, the proposal that the Hobart Women's Shelter would pay full rates puts council ahead financially, I would suggest.
So I suppose to help, I guess, Councillor Fox and her concerns that she voiced earlier was that this will actually increase our resources rather than drain our resources.
Mr. Smith.
Through you, Mayor, yes, I would agree with that comment.
Perfect. Okay, so I don't really want to go back and echo everything else. I'm supportive. I think it's a great initiative, and really congratulate the Mayor and the staff on hopefully getting this off the ground and look forward to it. I would just say how great it would be, again, call a motion if you want, but how great it would be to have a housing commitment that we could refer to these kind of decisions. So, but yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. And again, thank you, Mayor, for the work you've done on this, and also thank you to Councillor Fox for her passion on this. It is a sensitive topic. I was going to basically bring up the same points that Councillor Dean did, that aside from all of the emotive stuff that goes with this issue, when you get it down to brass tacks, we actually end up being in front, and it's... The women's shelter are, as I understand it, actually exempt from paying the rates, and as part of this deal, they've voluntarily decided to do that. So again, yeah, I thank Councillor Fox for her passion, but I think on balance, I think this is a great proposal. It has great community benefit. It's great financially for the council. It's winning all round.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. If there are no further comments, I'll make a contribution before I ask Councillor Midgley to close the debate. Look, I'm really pleased that we are at this point where we look like we'll make a decision in principle to support the donation of this land. It's nearly a year ago since the Hobart Women's Shelter came to the Greater Hobart Mayors Forum and said, look, we've got this problem. We know that there is state and federal funding available to construct long-term housing and crisis housing, but we don't have any land. And, with a plea, could all councils please look at what suitable land we might have? And despite what
many people in the community might think we don't own a great amount of land. And, you know, over the years we've had odd blocks of land that have been zoned residential that we've disposed of. Most recently, about 3 years ago, when we then moved down the path of putting some of that, selling off some of those blocks and putting the funds from those into playground upgrades. And so it was highly unusual that we're able to find a site that actually met the criteria that the women's shelter have for location, and that is easy access to public transport, easy access to schools, easy access to other services, because we can't make the assumption that everybody has a private car that they're able to utilise. And so the location for this, near sporting facilities, near all those other things, is absolutely perfect. And I think the thing that sealed it for me was hearing that 8 out of 10 women who turn up at the Hobart Women's Shelter are turned away. So it's not 8 out of 10 who are actually able to be helped. It's 8 out of 10 who are being turned away because their clients are staying longer in emergency housing because there's nowhere else for them to go. And this is where this facility will play such a significant role in the future, by being able to provide longer term accommodation for women and children after they've exited out of the crisis accommodation. So this is, I think, a significant partnership for us to be entering into. I think it's something that we should be exceptionally proud of. And, you know, we're not the first to do something like this. It's great to see that there have been other councils who have provided gifting of land for affordable and social housing. And I would like to see more of this in the future. And I hope other councils can look at this and say, well, gee, this is a model that can work. Because I think as many councillors have said tonight, this is a partnership. Ideally, in the ideal world, we would stick to the list of things under Local Government Act that we are to do. But there is a partnership here that needs to take place in order to facilitate something in what we know is an increasing time of crisis. So I sincerely thank members for their contributions tonight. This is something that I feel, like others around this table, very passionate about, and I'm just pleased that we've identified something, and I do hope that we can give in principle support and we can see this move forward. So I will now, if there's no further speakers, hand over to Councillor Midgley to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you so much for the background information for us. And again, your advocacy again. Without it, we wouldn't be here tonight. And it is an emotive issue because, yep, it is real. You walk around Blackmans Bay, you go to Hobart. Like 20 years ago, we didn't see that. It's real now. And so that's why we're making this decision tonight, because as many of us have stated, the local, state and federal governments need to work together. The Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute has many articles on what local governments can do. Universities are talking about it. It's out there. It's current. And we're acting on it. And like the Mayor, it is a really proud night to be able to support this in principle proposal. They have a design that's ready. They've been working hard behind the scenes. It's a trauma-informed proposal they're also putting together, which is another important point. And hopefully we can, as the Mayor said, provide a model again that other local Greater Hobart councils, Huonville, Hobart, Glenorchy, Clarence, can look to and say, okay, they can start pulling their socks up and really think about some land that they might have available as well, because it needs to happen. These units will provide some, but there is a lot more that needs to be done. So I look forward to us moving this along. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. I'll put the motion now as printed in the agenda. It's moved by Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. We move now to page 151, Donohoe Gardens Park, with a recommendation on page 154. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Councillor Gladewright, seconded Councillor Antoli. Councillor Gladewright.
So the purpose of this report is to consider community feedback in relation to the proposed development of the Donohoe Gardens Park. It seems that some consultation was undertaken, and most of the feedback from the community who were living around that park basically said they didn't want the upgrade and that funds would be better used upgrading a different park. So the officers have come up with a suggestion that Mount Royal Park could be a suitable park to upgrade instead. I think it's a good idea. I don't see why we wouldn't do that, given that most of the residents around Donohoe were concerned about the interruption of their views. They were concerned about a reduction of the value of their property due to the decreased views. There were a whole list of concerns that they had. So given that there's strong opposition from the adjoining residents, I think it's a good idea that we use it somewhere else. So I support the recommendation that we put the funds towards the upgrade of Mount Royal Park instead.
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. I've got Councillor Street and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. In principle, given the engagement that we've had with the residents of Donohoe Gardens, I don't have any trouble transferring the funds. My query is in relation to the park that we're going to transfer them to, though. My understanding was when we did the engagement for the playground strategy and decided on the allocation of these funds or the potential allocation of these funds from land sales, Mount Royal Park was pretty low down the list. Because of its location and the fact that it's enclosed by private property on all sides and isn't particularly well utilised, though I'm sure it is well loved by the residents in the immediate area. So my query is, are we sure that this is the highest and best use of those funds? And is there anything else on the list that could be considered in addition to Mount Royal Park?
Mr. Smith.
Through you, Mayor, the Mount Royal Park venue was certainly one that was a high priority, and that's the reason that engagement process has been undertaken. So in terms of how it rates as a park, it rates as unsatisfactory. In terms of the level of community desire to see an upgrade, it's really high. In terms of its location, Council's resolution was around upgrading parks in the area in which land was sold. So, you know, this is very much within that Kingston, Blackmans Bay area. So I'm really comfortable that the proposal to shift the funding is appropriate for Mount Royal Park. There's certainly a highly engaged community there. The facility is in need of upgrading, and certainly our previous urban designer very much had this as next cab off the rank in terms of his priority list, hence he'd done that work in terms of the engagement with that community.
Councillor Street.
I'm just hoping that Mr. Smee might be able to refresh my memory. Do we have Maranoa Heights on that list of priority projects? Have we already allocated something there?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, Maranoa Heights is not on the list of allocated funding. That's not to say it doesn't rate as a high priority, but bearing in mind the majority of our playgrounds under the audit that was done, rated as unsatisfactory. Now, that's not to say they're unsafe. It's primarily around, and it's very similar to the one at Donohoe Gardens. The playground at Donohoe Gardens is fine. It's to do with contemporary expectations in relation more to the park than the playground, and that's around trees and shade and seating and accessible pathways and all of those things you'd expect to find in a modern day park. So whilst Maranara has no funds allocated to it at the moment, it's certainly up there in terms of our priority listing. And I would point out that Council's resolution with respect to the land sales was that any surplus funding goes into the public open space account, and that will be assessed on its merits in terms of future developments and use of those funds. In relation to Donoghue Gardens, the notional allocation for that was 250. There is 352 effectively the net proceeds from the sale from Herne Road, and I would suggest that a preliminary assessment of the needs at Mount Royal would be that we would be spending around the $200,000 mark. However, we haven't done the detailed work on the costing yet. So there will be surplus funds available both from the sale of Herne Road and some of our other land sales. And if councillors consider, for example, Maranara to be a priority, we can certainly look to allocate those surplus funds to that particular play space.
Councillor Street.
Mayor, look, I can't speak for my other colleagues, obviously, but Maranara Heights is a high priority for me, given the fact that I don't think the playground up there meets community expectations, especially for an area the size of Maranara Heights, and given the high number of young families in the area. So certainly, from my perspective, if there are surplus funds to be spent, that would be pretty high up on my list of priorities.
Thank you, Councillor Street. I had Councillor Dean next.
I echo Councillor Street's comments there. What we're essentially doing here is completely revisiting a former resolution that was from the 26th of October in 2020, where we had a very specific resolution that funding would go from 41 Herne Road to Donoghue Gardens. So we're already revisiting that and going back on, I say, that commitment. So if we are looking at, as part of that resolution was to go back locally, if we're already going back on, I say, going back on the commitment to upgrade Donoghue Gardens, I would strongly support Councillor Street in saying I would prefer to see money going to Maranara Heights than I would Mount Royal. But I guess for me, and this probably didn't get flagged by everyone, but for me there's some issue of process around the report that we're discussing here. So the facts, as we've already explained them, we committed to a couple of years ago to sell land. We did an audit of the playgrounds and Donoghue came as fifth. We also agreed, and I say we, the previous council agreed to then directly tie the money from Herne Road to this garden. So that is, as what we're discussing right now, a reversal of that decision, and I think that needs to be absolutely clear. After those decisions were made, council then undertook an engagement strategy, as they do for this project. And it's the engagement process, I guess, I have my main concerns about. So reading the report, I note that we've actually applied two different engagement methodologies. So for Mount Royal Park, we had an online submission or online survey with 68 submissions. For Donoghue Gardens, we had two on-site sessions with some letterboxing, letting locals know that they were taking place, of which we had 10 actual pieces of feedback. Seven of those were opposed, and it seems those seven also wrote to council arguing that the upgrade would lead to antisocial behaviour and be a fire hazard and ruin their views and lose their money. I, for one, do not think that we should be behest to a handful of neighbours at a park to reverse decisions because of their self-interested views. I'm sorry, that just doesn't sit well with me as a councillor. So I'm not tied to Donoghue Gardens, I'm not tied to Mount Royal, I'm tied to the process, and I think we as council should really consider strongly the process that undertook here, because if we took an online submission around Mount Donoghue Gardens, for those families and people that work hard and don't have the time to attend an on-site decision, maybe we would have come with a different result. But we had 7 out of 10 say no, but we've only heard from 10 people. And I know for one, turning up to an hour-long session isn't always feasible. And so while there might be a lot of support out there for Donohue Gardens, we just haven't heard from it. And I fully appreciate that a lot of work has gone into this, and I don't note that a lot of survey and consultation went into to Mount Royal. But if we're here now looking at potentially reversing a serious decision from a few years ago, then I think it should be up for debate whether we do a similar consultation for Donohue Gardens, or we relook at this policy entirely to see where best this money is going to go to, because we clearly have signalled we've already got $350,000. There are other properties that are for sale, one near me right now. So there's a lot of money that potentially could be coming council's way, and we need to be very smart about how we're using that money. And if we're going to base shifting 250 grand's worth of upgrades based on a handful of neighbours, that sits really uncomfortable with me. So my questions, and I'd get to them eventually, was why did we take different under engagement strategies, one being an online submission survey and one being 10 people turning up on site. What informs the kind of engagement strategies that we choose as a council? And is there capacity in terms of if we see fit to go back and do a similar, if the cost isn't too high, to start this process necessarily again? Or should we throw it all out and actually look as a council, where do we now think our money should be best spent, particularly given that there's a significant amount of money coming our way over the next short term.
Mr. Smee.
Thank you, Mayor. A number of questions there. I guess before I answer the questions, I would point out that the selection of Donohue Gardens was made without there being the benefit of having done any community engagement. It was very much based on Donohue Gardens is the closest to Hume Road. So we didn't have the benefit of assessing the community appetite for an upgrade. It was purely, this is the closest one. We've now got to that point where the land's been sold, the funds are available, and staff have gone out and endeavoured to engage with the community. And I accept the argument that a lot of the opposition is driven by vested interest. But I guess part of the reason for recommending this is that if we had a groundswell of community support with a handful of vested interest opposed, then I would be recommending we push on and proceed in the greater community good. But in this instance, we offered both a midweek and staff turned out on a weekend. The whole community was letterboxed. The level of interest from the community in relation to this matter has been so low that we don't see value in proceeding with an upgrade that is clearly going to be strongly opposed and fought by the neighbouring residents. In relation to the engagement techniques, I guess in part they reflect change in staff. In part they reflect changes in our engagement platforms. We used to use Our Say, that's no longer available to us. And in part they reflect that Mount Royal was very much a community-driven process. The community came to us. They were very much on board in terms of we want to assist council through to determine the community need, and a survey was part of what the community said they saw as an appropriate engagement process. In relation to this one, we had a landscape architect, an external landscape architect, who we felt it was important was available to attend information sessions to discuss proposals with the community. Now, that landscape architect turned out twice and was met with a very disappointing response in terms of level of interest. So they are the main reasons for the difference in the engagement approach. You know, partly it's to do with there's a very different approach being made to these two. One's been very much a community driven. The other is council going out and endeavouring to bring the community in, and in endeavouring to do that, we haven't garnered a lot of interest.
Councillor Dean.
Yeah, thank you so much for the answer. I guess to follow up on Councillor Street's points around the appropriateness of Mount Royal Park, and I fully appreciate that it was a community-driven project and there's the Friends of Mount Royal Park that have kind of driven this. I'd be more comfortable if we were to actually revisit the use of these funds in a Kingborough-wide perspective. I don't necessarily agree with the criteria that was previously agreed to, that it should go to a nearby area. We live in a municipality, we raise money, it doesn't just because it happens to be on Herne Road. I don't believe any playground is high fit. Having noted, like I said, Don O'Guards was rated 5th out of 45 and Mount Royal wasn't much better. But I think, if I'm reading the room correctly, that there's potential priority for other areas in Maranoa that we address. So I'm a bit uncomfortable supporting this as it stands. I would prefer us to kind of hit the reset button, and I don't know how Councillor Street might suggest that we could kind of do that so that we know that we are going to potentially prioritise Maranoa without us spending $250 to $350 and leaving, as you said, potentially 100,000 or whatever is left over in the open space fund a bit short if we were to then go do Maranoa. So I'm very curious to see what the other councillors think on this one. I apologise, I didn't think this would be so controversial. I'm sure others didn't, but I do think it's worth the discussion right now.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Next I had Councillor Antoli, then Councillor...
I had it on a number of times.
Oh, and you've turned it off. Okay. Thanks. So then I've got Councillor Fox, then Councillor Antoli, then Councillor Gladright. Councillor Fox.
When I first read this document, I thought when we sold the land in Herne Road, it was really on the basis that something in the near neighbourhood would be developed for these local children. And I'm really disappointed to see that in order to walk to the playground we've selected, they have to cross Roslyn Avenue. And it's not within 500 metres of Herne Road, which is really the guiding principle around playgrounds, within 500 metres of even a place where you have a park where you can sit and talk to people is better than having to cross a highway and to go across to Mount Royal. So I guess it fails in terms of the process of selling the land in the first place and not having something closer, but also in the bigger picture of having something that's close to Herne Road that can be developed. And I'm just wondering, are there any playgrounds, existing parks that could be developed within 500 metres of Herne Road other than the Donoghue Park?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, I guess this comes back to Councillor Dean's point about the criteria being used that we sell a block here and the money needs to be spent within a radius of that block. That was very much, certainly at the time, that was not staff's recommendation. The recommendation from staff was that all of the proceeds from the sale of land would go into the open space account and they would be assessed on a municipal-wide basis. But the council at the time was very keen to see a benefit put back into the local community where the land was sold. So I'm not sure that it is the best process to say, well, we've sold a block here, therefore we need to develop a playground within that area, because it's not taking into account the demographics, the community need. I mean, the block could be sold in an area that has a high level of elderly people and no families, and, you know, I think we'd miss the mark there. So, and to answer Councillor Fox's question, I'm not aware of other playgrounds that are within that distance of Herne Road, but in saying that, I'm not sure that is a key criteria on which we should be making this decision.
Could I respond to that?
Councillor Fox.
I'm I'm concerned that land has a finite value, that you cannot buy land anymore in Blacktons Bay that we can afford. When land is given by a developer as part of their public open space contribution, that land is valued at the unimproved value and is part of that contribution. And the community, and that's the whole reason for public open space contributions, the community in the area where development is occurring has recreational land. It may well be surrounded by elderly people, but nobody is permanent. The elderly people give way to young families, and young families give way to elderly people, and so on and so forth. But the land remains. And like we have public open, that's why we take public open space. It's a public asset in perpetuity, which in this case we have sold. And I feel, I've always felt against the fact that we sold it, but I do feel we honour it. We must honour that decision that we were going to use that money in the local area to supplement the loss of value to those people of that public land. So it may well be that old council have old ideas and new councils don't agree with those ideas, but I think those decisions were made to sell that land on that very basis, because otherwise the decision may not have been made at all to sell that land. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. So this is my neck of the woods. I have letterbox dropped every street, door knocked almost every house. Donoghue Gardens is perfectly adequate. It's got a beautiful view, and the ratepayers around it, who have a right to participate in the process, have spoken. They say we don't want it. So we either do a ham-fisted approach where we have the evidence and we force it upon the ratepayers, or we let them speak. Down the road, you have pretty sad Mount Royal. It's a bit sad, to be honest. There aren't a lot of kids playing there. I find a bit more dog poo there than I find than there should be. It needs an upgrade. But I agree that Maranoa Heights needs an upgrade. I really do agree with that. And I personally don't agree with this policy that the land has to be, the land that is sold has to go back immediately there, because it needs to be based on evidence and demographics. How about I throw this one in? Why can't we split it? Half each. Half goes to Mount Royal. We will upset some people because it's not all going to Mount Royal. And the other half goes to Maranoa, and we will have them all happy and excited because they got something. Is that permissible?
Mr. Smith.
Through you, Mayor, if you're asking it's permissible, in terms of any regulation or council policy, yes, it's 100% permissible. It's purely a decision for council as to how it allocates these funds. In terms of will we upset people, I mean, I think the community at Mount Royal would be extremely grateful for any funding. And as I previously said, I don't think that the funding required to address the needs that they have identified, which are principally around additional shade tree plantings, accessible paths, are going to be of the order that, you know, we need to be spending $250,000. I think if the funding was split $175,000, for example, it would make a lot of people in that community very happy.
Thank you. And if I may, Mayor, so I know this area, Donoghue Gardens, is just off Jindabyne Road. It's quite a gentrified area. The kids have all pretty much grown up and gone. I think my kids are the youngest kids in the entire region. They're 15 and 13. They're not going to play there. Whereas down at Mount Royal, there are quite a number of young families there. So I can see why they're interested. So I'm proposing that we invest in both or similar as a concept. I don't know how we move that or amend that. Mayor, maybe you can advise me.
You can just propose an amendment.
Oh,
Okay, you can't, but somebody else can.
Well, I'll leave that to someone else maybe then. I did know that that's strategically why you don't second and move, because if you agree
with it, then you can say you agree with it, but that also depends on the mover of the motion. So I'm going to take Councillor... Well, okay, we've got an amendment for... Well, we haven't got an amendment foreshadowed. All right. Actually, you were next. Councillor Glaidwright, you were next on my list.
While we're all dreaming up ways to spend the money, I've got some ideas of my own, which I also put to Daniel Smee, but I was had that same response back, that no, it had to be used in the local area, so I went off that idea. But now that this is kind of back on the table, I'm getting a lot of feedback from the community that we spend a lot of money and that we're very Kingston-centric, and we've just spent $5 million on a playground here in Kingston. Mount Royal isn't so far. I know Maranoa still is kind of in that Kingston sort of area, but I'm getting a lot of lobbying from the community down in Snug that there aren't enough things for the teenage community to do down there. I asked that question last meeting about the cost of a pontoon. I know that there has been some nuisance adolescents who have been swimming out to yachts and having a bit of fun, so to speak, and I feel that a pontoon would be a really valuable asset to the Snug community. So while we've got 350, how about we spend 50 on a pontoon and then we go 150 Maranoa and 150 in Mount Royal? And I'd be happy to support that.
Councillor Glaidwright. Councillor Bain and then Councillor Richardson. And I'd just like to point out, as much as I'm enjoying this debate, that it's 8:50 and we still have one, two, three, four items in open session and a number in closed. And it's already quite late. And I'm positive, I can feel it in my waters, that Councillor Bain is hopefully going to suggest an amendment that will cut this short.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I'm not comfortable making decisions on the fly on allocating money. And we're talking about not allocating money to Donoghue because there's no public support for it, but then on the other hand saying let's go to Maranoa without knowing whether there's public support for that. So I think we should... Can we move it to be a budget discussion for...
So you're moving a deferral motion? Excellent. Okay.
Certainly.
Thank you very much. Councillor Bain has moved to defer the matter. Councillor Cordova has seconded it. So that now becomes the motion. All those in favour?
All right.
Against? The motion is carried. And I think along with that we might schedule a workshop at some stage to get this through at a later time. Okay, that takes us to page 160. Does anybody want a brief break, like a comfort stop of 5 minutes? Five? A toilet break is what I'm suggesting. Okay, let's have a 5 minute break, and please make it 5 minutes because we don't want to draw the pain out any longer. Apologies to those who are watching at home. Some of us have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, I know. All right. Can you... Okay. I did say I really meant five. Apologies. Are we back on? Okay, apologies to those people who have been watching at home. We're just, given that we've been in the room, we all hydrate. It was time for a quick toilet break, so thank you for your patience. Time being 9 p.m, we will resume the meeting. The next item on the agenda on page 160 is citizenship ceremonies on Australia Day, with a recommendation on page 161. Looking for a mover and a seconder. I have a mover in Councillor Midgley, and a seconder in Councillor Glaidwright. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Firstly, I'd like to thank staff for putting forward this motion, and I would like to acknowledge that I stand on stolen land this evening, and I acknowledge that the hurt that many Aboriginal people feel on January 26th. and that is why I'm supporting this small but significant step to change the date of citizenship ceremonies in Kingborough from either a few days prior or a few days after the 26th of January. And it's pleasing to see the Albanese government has put forward this option. It has been a long time coming. In an article in The Age, it stated that seven councils in Victoria changed their citizenship ceremonies this year from the 26th of January, and we know locally that the Glenorchy Council did not hold theirs on the 26th this year, and the Brighton Mayor has publicly acknowledged they'll be changing in 2024. And I did listen to the Hobart City Council debate last night as well, and noting that they have also agreed, and the debate was rather interesting. In the article in The Age, it also provided a story from Uncle Gardiner from Wurundjeri Country in Victoria, who conducted the Welcome to Country at his local council. He stated, "Holding the ceremony 2 days before Australia Day was much easier for him personally and his community." He stated, "It's important because I don't have to have any mourning thoughts today about the tragedies that occurred in the past," he said. "Today is a day celebrating citizenship for people that are wanting to become citizens in the country, and I feel much more welcoming of people, bringing them into the community and including them in the broader population today." So I won't go on too much. I've been a supporter of Invasion Day marches since I was 18. I see the 26th of January as a day of mourning. I walk and stand with the Aboriginal Tasmanian community. So let's unite our community rather than divide us. Let's not celebrate on a day of mourning. And I feel this step is moving towards equality and healing, a step towards closing the gap and treaty. And I hope all councillors can give this small step, because it is a small step of many bigger things that the government needs to do, and support and change the date of citizenship ceremonies in Kingborough in January.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further speakers? Councillor Fox.
The last citizenship ceremony I attended, Sarah Wilcox spoke from the heart, and she was representing the Aboriginal community, and she welcomed the new citizens to Kingborough and to Australia. And I thought it was such a warm-hearted speech that she gave, and it was absolutely beautiful and so generous of her, particularly on the day of invasion. Well, it wasn't Invasion Day that day, but to expect people to do that on Invasion Day I think would be very difficult. But apart from that, I feel it would be a really good idea to have the citizenships on any other day but that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Antoli, then Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Mayor. My contribution is that I will be voting not in favour. I would like to quote to everyone present what the Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs Minister of the Albanese Government said on this subject, as quoted in the ABC, and I quote as follows: "It is the Australian Government's strong expectation that councils conduct ceremonies on January 26. I continue to quote, "The Australian Government implores councils to have new citizens as their key focus, recognising that many community members want to complete their journey to Australian citizenship in connection with Australia Day." So we are not to mix the legitimate concerns of the Indigenous community of Australia with the legitimate needs of Australian citizens to become citizens on Australia Day. We're not putting them as the focus. And so I would say that before we make this change, how about we actually survey our community to ask them if they want the change, rather than imposing it upon them unrequested. I do not look upon Australia Day as Invasion Day. The first fleet landed in Botany Bay on January the 18th. January the 26th is when the flag was raised at Sydney Cove. If you want to use an invasion day, it was January the 18th. So we've got the wrong day. So let's not undermine and divide our society. Let's have two separate discussions. Let's keep the Australian citizens at the centre and the focus, and not fiddle with the day unless they ask for it. And that's why, primarily, I will not be supporting the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli, beg your pardon, Councillor Richardson, and then Councillor Gladright.
Yeah, thank you. Look, another very emotive issue that you know we need to handle with some sensitivity. My take on this is a little bit of separating the two issues. The ceremony, the citizenship ceremony that I went to recently was just wonderful. Lots of smiling faces there, very happy to become Australian citizens. Rightly or wrongly, at this point in time, Australia Day is our national day, and I think it's appropriate that we invite new citizens to join our community on our national day. Should that national day move to another day, whether it's in January or not, the citizenship ceremony should absolutely follow wherever that national day is, whether it's called Australia Day or whether it's something else. I don't feel like it's insensitive to say that new citizens should be able to be welcomed into our community on our national day. The issue of when Australia Day or when our national day should be, I feel is a different and far bigger issue.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. Councillor Gladright, then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, I'm going to speak in support of the recommendation. I feel that it is a real shame that we don't have a federal government who has already decided that we need to change the day of Australia Day from the 26th. I hear what you say, Councillor Antoli, that actually the boats arrived on the 18th, but I think that given that the flag was hoisted on the 26th of January in 1788, that has become the significant moment of the invasion. So I am a strong supporter of changing the date of Australia Day. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet, and we're now being asked whether we should be changing the date of our citizenship ceremonies. It would be ideal if Australia Day was changed first, but that hasn't happened. So I'm hoping that as more and more councils are changing their dates, it will actually be a sign to the federal government that actually there is a lot more support for changing the date. I was very alarmed to read the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 4% of our community identify as Indigenous, and nationwide 3% identify as Indigenous. No wonder they call it Invasion Day. There's only 3% left. It is really, really sad. A day that is so divisive and is so disrespectful is the complete opposite of what you want from a national holiday. Yes, of course, we want to welcome our new citizens in connection with Australia Day, but while it currently exists on a day that is so divisive and so disrespectful, I cannot support keeping the date of our citizenship ceremonies on the 26th of January.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Councillor Dean.
Thanks, Councillor Midgley, for, I guess, presenting the perspective of the First Nations people in Australia, and that is a really important point that we do need to consider in this thing. But just to go to a couple of Councillor Antoli's points, I suppose, I fully appreciate that is the official position of the Australian government. That is absolutely, until they change the date, it will be their official position. And to agree with Councillor Gladright that it's almost a temperature test for me. They wouldn't have allowed that flexibility if they aren't showing some willingness to, down the track, change that day. Because I think, Councillor Richardson pointed to, yes, we would ideally like the federal government to make a call on this so we can feel a bit more comfortable about changing the date. But what we're talking about here is one of four ceremonies. And the one we attended a few weeks ago was amazing and it was fantastic. But I've had no one come to me to say they would like it needs to be on this day. I've had migrants that have changed, become citizens, actually talk about how they do feel uncomfortable about having to be on this day. And I've reiterated the point that this is one of four. And I guess the other point I'd like to make, just to address Councillor Andoli's point, is that we have gone to the community on this. And I feel like someone that can represent the younger people in Kingborough, and time and time again over years, we are showing that polls loud and clear say that young people are absolutely fine with changing their date. It is not a big deal for them. They want a day that we can all celebrate and get behind, and I think that's what everyone here would like to see. And I think the motion here, or the recommendation here, just gives us that little bit of flexibility. It still means that we award citizenship four times a year, but for the hurt that it causes a large part of our community in Australia, and also the antipathy of others to go, as long as they get their day and they can celebrate together, then I really have no issues whatsoever to support this. And I hope that if more councils do take the initiative to do this, then yes, the federal government will change the day, and then we can just actually move on and hopefully celebrate all together on the same day, because that's not what the issue is about. It's not about getting rid of Australia Day.
Thanks very much. Councillor Dean. I've next got Councillor Bain, then Councillor Street.
Yes, I'm going to echo some of the things that other people have said. As Councillor Richardson said, I'm trying to separate the two issues in terms of we're not making a decision here to move Australia Day. We're making a decision to move the date of a citizenship ceremony. And in my eyes, as Councillor Dean said, we hold four of these a year, and I don't think the one on the 26th is going to be any more significant than the other three that are held for those people attending. And but on the flip side, I do think that some of the people who are allocated to the 26th, the occasion is probably a lesser experienced for their special day. And for that reason, I think if we choose to move the date to a couple of days either side of the 26th, the people attending, it's still going to be just a special occasion as if it was the 26th. But the risk of people not enjoying that day is taken away. So for that reason, I'll be voting for the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Councillor Mayor Reid. Councillor Reid. I suppose you are also Councillor Reid, aren't you? Mayor, this is a very divisive issue in our community. There's no doubt about that. There are views strongly held on both sides. I want to talk a little bit about our new citizens and the citizenship ceremony itself. I think Councillor Bain has hit the nail on the head in a lot of respects, including that that date being on the 26th of January, because of the divisive nature of the argument, does have the ability to cast a pall on a new citizen's first day as an Australian citizen. And I'm sorry that they feel that way. And I'm sorry that we have ended up in a situation where our National Day has caused that to be a possibility. I also think that for our new citizens, we have four ceremonies a year. And out of three of those four ceremonies, we're able to share the occasion with the first Australians, with our nation's first people, and I think that's an incredibly powerful statement about Australian citizenship that we miss out on because of what has become quite a divisive day. And that's not to say one way or the other whether Australia Day should be moved. That is just the reality. That because of the nature of the day, we miss out on having First Nations representatives at that ceremony. We miss out, and our new citizens miss out, and I think that's disappointing. I don't believe that our new citizens' first day as a citizen in January is going to be any less for it not being on our National Day. I think that our new citizens who experience the other three ceremonies have as meaningful day, if not more, for the presence of our First Nations people on those three other days. And so it's on that basis that I do support the recommended motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I support the motion wholeheartedly, and I really enjoy our citizenship ceremonies. I mean, there's not too many other events that are quite so uplifting and enjoyable. You meet new people and there's such a genuine sense of excitement and anticipation and real pleasure in joining this great family. And so I think it's a special day, and Councillor Bain put it so well. I thought that was such a reasoned and it was such a reasonable way of putting it, that we're going to be more inclusive by changing the date, I believe. And I think that it is a small step, in the sense that there's systemic injustice that we know is going on, there's systemic oppression, and none of that will necessarily be changed by us changing the date. But what it will do is signal clearly to the federal government that we are aware and alert to these issues, that we're sensitive to them. I'd make the point that a treaty or treaties will probably give everyone a reason to celebrate. So in 1938, Yorta Yorta man William Cooper called for January 26 to be acknowledged as a day of mourning, and First Nations people have rallied on that date ever since. And in solidarity with First Nations people, I think it is good that we are able to make our date for the citizenship ceremonies that much more inclusive. I think also it's worth noting that we at this council have lowered the flag on, we've lowered the Aboriginal flag on Australia Day, and that was done, lowering the flag to half mast. I believe we did that, it was under the time when Mayor Winter was there. I believe we did that in a sign of respect for those who died as a result of racially motivated violence from the frontier wars and deaths in custody and all of the other systemic injustices that we know have taken place against First Nations people. And the reason why that lowering of the flag to half-mast took place on January 26 was because it was a recognition that it's a day of mourning. So there's this incongruity between holding an Australia Day citizenship ceremony at the same time as having those deep-seated and heartfelt mourning, the process of mourning that's taking place for First Nations people in our community. I think this is a small step, but it's a positive one. I think it will help bring people together rather than divide them. And I think if we all walk forward in that spirit of generosity and goodwill together, we can start to forge a more meaningful process of reconciliation. But unless we take that leadership position, and I'm really pleased to see that other councils around the country are doing that, we have before us an opportunity, and I think it would be remiss of us not to take that opportunity to reach out an olive branch and to try and help bring the community together. And what that will mean ultimately is that we'll all be able to have that great sense of joy that I feel when I'm attending those citizenship ceremonies. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Before asking Councillor Midgley to sum up, I just wanted to make some comments in relation to this. One of the things that I find an incredible honour as Mayor is to be presiding officer at a citizenship ceremony, because it is such a significant time in someone's life when they pledge to become an Australian. And I see joy on the faces of people who come along to those ceremonies, whether it's one that we've had to hold on Australia Day or whether it's any of the other three throughout the year. And but we do know that there has been an increasing understanding in the broader community, not just in the Aboriginal community, but by others, that Australia Day causes pain for our First Nations people, and it's not a date that they wish to be remembered. And so I think it's great that the federal government have, whilst they've kind of giving mixed messages, I have to say, by just prior to Christmas moving the requirement and then making a statement to say there's an expectation that we continue to hold them. It's kind of like having a bet each way, so I don't quite understand. I don't understand that strategically, but they've given us the option, and I do think that it is incumbent upon us then, if that option is available to us, to consider
what's in the best interests of the majority of our community in this case, for those people who do find it difficult to have their ceremony on Australia Day because of their beliefs and understanding of our history, that is a day that causes pain, that they don't wish to receive their citizenship on that day. The important thing to understand is that you can't choose when your citizenship ceremony is held. I've seen various reports from people suggesting that the reason that ones are bigger on Australia Day is because they're popular. It doesn't work like that. You receive from the Department of Home Affairs a letter about 4 weeks before you're allocated to a citizenship ceremony, and you're told this is when it is, this is where it is, and if for some reason you're unable to attend, then you're allocated to a subsequent one. So it's not that people are actively choosing to go through that process on Australia Day and waiting for that. So I think that's a really important point to remember. So I think this has been a really valuable debate. I thank everyone for their contributions tonight, and I look forward to us moving forward with this, and I will hand over to Councillor Midgley to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a quick question.
You can't have a question when you're summing up.
Well, I don't want to sum up yet. I just want to ask a question before I sum up. Can I? Doesn't matter. I'll ask the General Manager later. It's all good.
Yep.
I have nothing to say, but just nothing else to add. But thank you very much for what was really an amicable debate and discussion, and most of the points put forward were very pleasant to listen to, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. I'm going to put the motion now. Moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Gladewright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Against.
I'll have a show of hands, please. All those in favour? It's Councillors Fox, Cordova, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson, Street, Gladewright and Reet. Those against? Councillor Antoli. The motion is carried. We turn now to page 162. I'm going to hand the chair over to Councillor Gladewright so that I can actually move this motion. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. So the next item on the agenda is 17.7, Kingborough Disability Inclusion and Access Advisory Committee minutes, dated the 14th of December 2022. I have a mover in Councillor Reet. Do I have a seconder, please? A seconder in Councillor Fox. Councillor Reet.
Thank you very much. For some time now, as our previous councillors would be aware, the Access Committee have been looking at the possibility of having beach matting at Kingston Beach to enable access to the water by people using mobility devices such as wheelchairs. We've been working on this as a committee for about 18 months. We had previously discussed it last year, but the stumbling block that we came across at the time was that there is the type of matting that we were looking at would need to be rolled in and out every day, maintained, etc., and there was going to be a significant upfront cost, but then a significant recurrent cost. And we've done some subsequent work and found that there is a more cost-effective way of doing it, and importantly, what has resolved some of the funding issues, although there will still be a small ongoing cost, is that the Kingston Beach Surf Lifesaving Club have now indicated that they would be willing to roll the matting out, that would be a really positive thing. There is only one other beach in Tasmania that has accessible beach matting, and that's Park Beach at Dodgers Ferry. And I think it would be wonderful if we could have this, and during the season when the Surf Life Saving Club are there, that we can have this rolled out. And it complements very nicely the accessible ramp that we now have at the beach, and also the beach wheelchairs that the Surf Life Saving Club have that are available. So Obviously we need to go through a process. There would need to be some community consultation around the installation of the mat, and also there are some, it would be put up as a funding bid during the upcoming budget process, and put up against other bids, and we'll have that discussion. But certainly from the Access Committee point of view, this is something that has been on the wish list for a while, and we finally feel like we've found a way to advance this and to make sure that we're as inclusive as we possibly can be of all beach users and their ability to get to the water. So I look forward to your contributions. Thank you.
Councillor Dean.
I just want to say how fantastic this is, and well done to those on the committee and to the Mayor obviously for chairing and getting this across the line. And to be the second municipality in Tasmania that does this, it's really good, and a proud moment for us, I think, if we can get this done. Just one question, I suppose, probably for you, Mayor, is about, given that Sorrel have got a permanent mat that's accessible year-round that doesn't involve anyone paying or Surf Life Saving Club to, I guess, administer it. What was the conversation just there, if you could quickly, in terms of why we didn't go down the permanent? Is it the nature of the beach or just the upfront cost or what might have been there?
So I'm not aware what the arrangements that they have at Dodgers Ferry are and whether there is any funding, but there was the costing that we had for the recurrent funding for the previous matting that we were looking at was going to be in the order of $30,000 to $40,000 to be able to roll it out. And the discussion amongst the previous council when we were considering that, with the limited recurrent funding that we had that was discretionary, was that we couldn't justify it at that stage. This is now a system that we believe is far more usable in terms of where we would store it, and we would store it underneath the accessible ramp that goes down, so it's a far easier roll in and roll out, and it looks like a more user-friendly type of matting than previously we'd looked at.
Yeah, that sounds all really great. I just guess getting at the point is if there's another council nearby has a permanent fixture with no recurrent funding that's accessible all year round.
I'm not sure if it's accessible.
It is. It's a permanent.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, yeah. So it's all there. It's there all the time. And cost mitigation, obviously, for the Surf Life Saving, great. But obviously only certain days that they're able to do it, I'm sure. It's not going to be every day. So yeah, I'd just obviously love to have it all year round and not have to pay for it every single year for the rest of our lives. That's, I guess, my point. It's not really anything to add here, I suppose. It just may be a consideration that as we go back to potentially doing this, if there's one potential last check, potentially what the actual cost of making it permanent, I don't know.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. The matting, I'm just trying to understand, so the matting is used to allow a person to self-access the beach down, I'm assuming, up to where the waves start lapping on the shore, or is it to give them access into the water on their own?
So it would be to give them access to I guess, the tidal line.
Yep.
And hard sand, because obviously, depending on what mobility device they're using, they need to be on a relatively solid surface. So there would be different lengths of matting that could be rolled out because it comes in sections. So when it's rolled out, if the tide for that at that particular time is low, then it would be double length. If it's high, then it would be single length.
So it allows a person who's in a wheelchair to self-access right up to the tidal line on their own without the assistance of someone else, because a lot of disabled people don't have a support person to help them with that.
Yep.
Otherwise, they're just standing, sitting in their car, looking at everything, unable to feel the breeze, touch the sand, etc.
Yeah. The other aspect of it is that, excuse me, that we're looking at is that instead of just your straight mat, you have like a couple of branches, if you like, that come off the side, and what that does is then enable somebody to come down. They might just want to be on the beach but not in the water, and they can park off to the side and have a picnic there or just sit there and watch the activity on the beach without then blocking the path of somebody else that needs it. So that's quite an innovative part of it as well.
And has funding been taken into account for the access point from their car to the start of the mat? Is there special works that need to be done for that, or we're just using existing works?
It's existing because it would the path to the accessible ramp is all there and ready, and likewise then it's opposite the toilets, etc. So it's kind of like the last piece in the puzzle.
Thank you.
Are there any further contributions?
Yes.
Councillor Fox and then Councillor Cordova.
I'm all for the beach matting. I know this has been an ongoing issue for many years. And the second part of the motion is that we install unisex accessible toilet facilities at all levels at the Gingra Sports Centre for inclusion in the budget. Have we got any idea how much they would cost? Because that would be a significant amount.
Councillor Rett.
No, but the bids have been prepared by staff or in the process of it. Issue at the moment is there are no accessible toilets in one part of the sports centre, and that's been identified by users of the centre and brought to the attention of the Access Committee. So that will be something that's being finalised at the moment. So when we consider the budget, it'll be another item on there for a capital works program.
But this motion is about all levels, not just one part of the sports
centre. Do you want to add to that, Mr. Smith?
Through you, Mayor, we've prepared two bids. One is for an accessible toilet on the level where the office is, and the other is the downstairs where the fitness centre is. So off the top of my head, I think the upstairs one is around $100,000 and the downstairs one is about $200,000.
Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. I support this motion. I think it's good, and I think it actually speaks well to our strategic outcome, wanting an inclusive community that has a strong sense of pride and local identity, and it does just that. Particularly important is item 4.4 here on page 163 that talks about how the Kingra Sports Centre is a dedicated emergency evacuation centre, and therefore it's of utmost importance that we actually have these universally accessible provisions. And then I do note at 5.2 in the finance section, it talks about the costs associated with those installations at 5.1 and 5.2. Once again, it's the principle of the thing that's almost more important than the detail here, and that it's that principle of inclusivity and making sure that we're a council for everyone in the municipality and not just a few. And so to that end, I wholeheartedly support the motion, and I want to thank the author and authoriser for putting it all together, and of course the Disability Access Inclusion Committee as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Bain.
I was just going to raise the same thing, that the dollars are in the finance section of the report. So one of the top... So 5.2, I'm reading, one of the toilets is $42,500 and the other one's $175,000. Can I just ask the question then? Is the 5.2 the correct figures?
Through the chair, yes, they would be. I was talking off the top of my head, but evidently I was somewhat out.
Well, it's a win because it's come down to $42,500, so it's a good news story. the only other question I had is, do you think the Disability Committee would rate these in number in priority as part of their budget submission? So if there's only enough money for one of them, will they give us some recommendation of which one they think is the most important?
We have a meeting on Wednesday, so I can certainly seek that advice from them. But the beach, I mean, it's hard to pick, isn't it? Because the beach matting is something we've been working on for years. But we also have the other issue of the sports centre with the dual purpose there, that it's not just for people who are using the sports facility but as the emergency evacuation place. And if we ever were in a situation where we had to have to utilise that, we could find ourselves with some difficulties. So, but I'll seek that advice from them on Wednesday and let you know.
Councillor Midgley. Thank you. Just a question. I'm wondering, because it is also for a purpose of emergency evacuation centre, I wonder if there's any federal government grants perhaps that could be around for that, just a thought, to make centres more accessible and things like that.
Mr. Smee.
Through the chair, possible but highly unlikely.
Are there any further questions or contributions? Councillor Reet, would you like to sum up?
I'd just say thank you for the support, and the Access Committee will be very pleased to hear that this will be going forward in the budget process for further consideration, so thank you.
So I'll put the motion as printed on the screen. It was moved by Councillor Reet, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? The motion is carried.
Thank you very much, Deputy Mayor. We turn now to page 177 with a recommendation on page 178. It's the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee. We're in need of a deputy chairperson. So before asking for a mover or a seconder, I'm going to ask if anybody would like to have their name inserted into the recommendation. Do we have any nominees to be on the Bike Advisory Committee? Councillor Gladewright, any further nominees? No? Okay. The recommendation then that is going forward is that Councillor Gladewright be appointed as a council representative and deputy chairperson of KBAC, and the committee members be advised accordingly. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Dean and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Thank you very much. Page 179, Notices of Motion. Councillor Dean has submitted a Notice of Motion headed Housing Statement, and we have an Officer's Response from Dr. Fox. So I have a mover in Councillor Dean, and I'm looking for a seconder, and I have it in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Dean.
I'm so aware of the time, and I'm so aware that this Notice of Motion came on the back end of a massive agenda, so I will try and cut this as short as I possibly can, but I do acknowledge that this is a serious one, and I really want to hopefully have a positive debate about this one. So, look, I've put it before us because, you know, I personally want us to make sure that we're doing everything we can as a council to support our residents who have... We talked about a housing crisis for a long time, but to be honest, it's been happening for quite a few years. And so there's still time to do stuff. It's not like the housing crisis is over by any stretch. I've submitted a fairly lengthy supporting statement there, so I'm not going to go and repeat all of that. I don't need to repeat the statistics. I think we're all aware of what's going on in our community right now. So many anecdotal evidence. Sure, there's some statistics in here, but look, whether it's a young person who can't move out of home because they just can't afford to get into a share house, whether it's older residents who we know who can't downsize because there's nothing affordable to downsize to, or it's residents that are being pushed directly into homelessness, couch surfing, crisis accommodation, like the women's shelter we discussed before. But it's also first home buyers who have got into the market in the last year or two, who have been jacked to the hilt with massive mortgages, and now they're facing cost of living pressures and rapidly rising interest rates. So it's not like just because you own a house, all of a sudden you're rich at the moment. So we know it's doing our community really tough at the moment, and that's the main instigator for putting this forward. We've had discussions earlier about the women's shelter, and I think it's clear that council, state or federal government acting alone aren't going to get the job done. And so if we look at what other councils are doing, I think there's an opportunity for us to learn and to make sure that we're formalising, I suppose, what we do as a council, and making sure that we've got a commitment to our residents about taking a little bit more action and doing what we absolutely can. Look, I've highlighted the purpose of this statement, but I want to add a couple of points I've jotted down here in terms of actually the benefits of undertaking this work if we go ahead with it. First, I want to show our residents that we take the issue seriously, and it's not we don't drop out that argument that it's not council's issue, we don't need to fix it. And it will also show what we're already doing, because I'm fully aware that tonight is a fantastic example of where there's stuff going on behind the scenes, that it's nice to just formalise that and show that what we're actually already doing. And apart from our residents, I think it's really important to show our key stakeholders that our council is committed to addressing the housing challenge that we face. I hope it will pave the way for more projects like the one we just discussed tonight, more partnerships with community housing providers. And as the Kingston CBD is going to see lots of apartments come online over the next few years, I think this will give our development partner traders in purple the ability to actually go and push for more funding, I hope anyway. So ultimately, those apartments by nature will hopefully be a bit more affordable if we're given the opportunity to have smaller living spaces, which is what we're going to transition to or need to transition to. And third, I think it will act as a good framework or decision-making guide for us as a council when it comes to our strategic planning on housing. And again, tonight's example is a really good one where we could refer to that and say, yes, this ticks off a commitment of ours to in terms of disposal of land and encouraging more affordable housing options. So I've kept that as short as I possibly can. I really, really thank the officers, Dr. Fox, for her response to ensuring that I suppose that this is actually a possibility. And my first question, I suppose, and only question, will be whether Dr. Fox could explain from her experience what it's been like to do similar work in another council and what benefits you think it might bring us in Kingborough to have a housing commitment.
Dr. Fox. Through you, Mayor, and thanks for the question. As we have discussed, I worked on a statement of commitment on housing at Glenorchy City Council and was very strongly in support of doing that work, and I think it had great benefit for Glenorchy. It had benefit for councillors, aldermen at Glenorchy, in advocating for federal and state government investment in housing in the municipality. It was a strong indication to those levels of government that Glenorchy was committed, had significant unmet need, and would partner, as we've discussed tonight, would partner in those sorts of initiatives and provide the support that could be provided. It was also a really strong indicator to housing developers, whether that's Housing Tasmania or private developers, that Glenorchy wanted to do business in this space. We were very committed and that we would facilitate housing developments of all kinds in the municipality through our planning scheme and through the work that we did. It also showed our residents that we were aware of the issues that they were facing and that we would do everything in our power as a council to help them in that situation. In terms of disposal of council land, it was also important to highlight to the community that that would be one of the forefronts in consideration. So we would be looking at whether in disposing of land it could be used for housing of different sorts, and that would be one of the priority uses of land that was disposed. There was also a role in educating and informing and working with members of the community who might not have been so, might not have seen housing developments, affordable and social housing developments, as favourable in the neighbourhood. So it was about having a conversation with the community and saying this is the type of development that council would like to see, and this is the type of development that will help the people of our community in their lives and create opportunities for people. So it was a really good process, I think, for aldermen, councillors in this case, but also for council staff. Internally, we developed up the statement through a working group, and I would propose if this goes ahead, we'd do the same here, which included managers and coordinators within council. We met regularly to make sure that we were all still progressing. It wasn't just a piece of paper, that we were actively working towards implementing more housing in the municipality. And we reported back to council at regular, you know, annual and as requested, to just say what we had been doing but also how the stats were going. Because it is, housing is such a massive issue for our community, and council has limited levers, it's really important to understand how that need is going and how well that need is being met or not met, and where the particular areas of need are, whether that's social housing or crisis accommodation, supported accommodation, homelessness services, etc., etc. I'm rambling, but it was certainly a very powerful process in my mind for Glenorchy, both for the council, the elected officials, the community, but also for council staff.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I support the motion and I thank Councillor Dean for bringing it to us. I'm particularly excited about the possible action section there on page 180, where we're talking about, you know, potentially developing formal partnerships with community housing providers, prioritising affordable social and crisis accommodation opportunities when disposing of council land, advocating for state and federal government funding to develop affordable and social housing, and encouraging mixed-use precincts for new developments and existing upgrades. That's something I'm particularly passionate about, ensuring that when we do have new developments, such as Kingston Park, that we can see certain amounts set aside for social and affordable housing, and I believe Huntingfield has that commitment of maybe it's 15% social and affordable housing. Advocating to the Tasmanian Planning Scheme to include incentives for affordable housing projects, and reviewing current policies related to land sales and conducting land audits to identify areas for affordable housing development. I think this is all good stuff. I'm particularly interested to find out what model we will go down, whether it's the Hobart City Council model or the Glenorchy model. But I do think fundamentally this is a worthy use of council resources and staff time to put our mind to it, to put a focus on it. But I do think I was very pleased to hear about this notion of measuring or reporting back, or what are the... We need to make sure that it's strategic and measurable. So I don't know whether it's worth maybe putting in some kind of amendment about timeframes or reporting timeframes, just so that it isn't a piece of paper that sits on a shelf somewhere, that we're actually using it to look back at how we're tracking. So I think there is indeed going to be benefit for the municipality by us having this. It will keep councillors on track, and I think it will also help staff by having a framework there. So, yeah, once again, I think it's a good initiative and it's a good place to start. I think it will work in tandem with the other things that council is currently doing to address the housing crisis. There's always more to be done, but this is a good initiative, so I'll support it. Thank you.
Councillor Antoli, then Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a great proposal. I heartily support it, and I realise it's late, but it's not Councillor Dean's fault. We have a full schedule and you shouldn't apologise for it. This is what you do when you're elected officials. Sometimes you do have to work back a bit late. If you don't like it, then don't be in this game. So it's a good proposal. I support it, and I can't see the state government making a major impact on housing until they adopt more of this partnership with local councils as well. Same with the federal government.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Good on you, Councillor Dean. This is fantastic and well done. And thank you, Dr. Fox, as well, for your input and your experience at Glenorchy putting this forward as well. I've had a look at the Glenorchy statement, had a look at some others. The Hobart one, I think, needs an officer full-time to implement. There's many actions. It's 40 pages. It's great to see that Dr. Fox has had a short, concise experience of putting something together at the Glenorchy Council. One of the things that I see in that, and some of the points that Councillor Cordova raised, was really around like a time frame. Like, I'd love to see if it was like a 23-26 kind of commitment that can be reflected on, because just in the last 5 years we've seen so much changes in the housing sector. And also if there could be a really brief kind of set of actions, perhaps it can be measurable outcomes that maybe could be reported on or something like that. That would be what I would like to see, but really don't want it to be a massive task, but it's great to have the commitment for all the many reasons that Councillor Dean has mentioned tonight, and the many reasons that you've been able to use the advocacy for the Glenorchy one.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Any further comments? If not, I'll just make a couple of comments. Yes, thank you, Councillor Dean, for bringing this to us this evening. And as has already been mentioned, it's unfortunate that it's at the end of a very long agenda, but that certainly doesn't
detract from the fact that this is a great step forward for us, and that there is a huge amount of support around this table for developing something that would send a clear message about where, as a council, that we stand on wanting to do our part in when it comes to affordable and social housing, as we've already discussed this evening. So thank you very much for the work that you've put into bringing this to us. And would you like to sum up?
Only to say it does genuinely feel good to hear the comments from fellow councillors on this. It's clearly something that's important to me, but it's nice to hear that everyone's on the same page. And I should say this, I've just brought a motion forward. You guys will hopefully vote for it. And Dr. Fox really was the catalyst in the conversations that we had. And when I heard that she'd already done similar work, I thought this was an achievable outcome. And I really, really look forward to, you know, what you present, and I acknowledge that the work will be done by you and your staff. It's us, we can bring motions forward, but at the end of the day, it's the staff that get the job done. And so in this case, I'm very, very appreciative of your work so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put the motion now, moved by Councillor Dean, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. We turn now to confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. We have confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence, acquisition of land for an underpass, 57 Summerlees Road, Kingston Wetlands upgrades and rates delegated authority. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox, the seconder in Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. In accordance with Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Open session of Council adjourned at 9:50 p.m.